This is the Patty Vasquez Show.
Follow me on Twitter at Patty Vasquez, CHI.
On 720 WGN.
Some people see the revolution, but most only see the girl. I can lose my hard-earned freedom if my fear defines my world. I declare my independence from the critics and their stones. I can find my revolution. I can learn to stand alone.
We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Do I have the show? Sometimes I don't know when the White Sox games end, especially when we win. There's a lot going on and we're doing our post game. And then they're like, you're on. Oh, hi, everyone. And joining me is Dr. John Duffy. Hey, Doc, how are you doing?
I'm great, Patty. How are you?
I feel badly because I feel like whenever you come in, I unpack all these stories and you're just kind of like, I don't know where we're going with this, but okay.
It is super exciting. I'm going to try to take notes when I leave here and let's see how accurate I am.
So I'll bring our off-air conversation to the air.
Great.
I was telling you about a guest that we had last week. By the way, hi, everybody. We're going to have a conversation with Dr. John Duffy tonight. If you want to call and join us anytime, if you have any questions or concerns, if there's something going on in your life, we're here. We're on in the middle of the night. We can't fix your problems. We're on the radio, but if you want to talk through something, the doctor's here, and we're both listening. So 312-981-7200. And I was wondering if you ever come across, or if there's a way for us, for yeah. those who are wading through life, trying to figure things out, if people tell you that they've had a breakthrough, or maybe they don't even realize that something happened and the emotions that they're feeling are because they had a breakthrough.
Right.
Have you ever had an instance where a client, I don't know what you call your patients, I guess?
Yeah, I usually say clients.
Yes.
Like the word clients. I think it's more empowering than patients somehow in the therapeutic context.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have worked with a lot of people who've had breakthroughs. And just as you were telling me right before you got on the air, sometimes people want their breakthroughs to be future oriented, like, you know, something
yes.
about like, oh man, this is where I'm going to go.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes the breakthrough is, oh, where I've been has been amazing.
Yes.
Like, you know, so to reflect on their lives and to recognize their accomplishments and be grateful for, I've done all this stuff and I've arrived at this place.
Yes.
How awesome is that? That happens more often than I think I know what I want to do sometime in the future,
uh-huh.
you know, because that's very esoteric, whereas the past is done and you kind of can really reflect on it and revel in it instead of, because some of us, when we look back at our past without bouncing it off of somebody,
yes.
we are able to pick out the negatives
yeah.
and feel like, I really haven't done much that's worthwhile or useful. But if you look back with somebody, if you have a sounding board,
mm-hmm.
often you find yourself like more grateful, like, oh, and I did this. And if you have somebody saying, you did what? That's amazing. And this happened, by the way, just
yes.
a minute ago, didn't
yes.
it? Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing is, and I, because I had heard you, I wanted to talk about that sort of breakthrough moment kind of feeling.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't want people to miss it. I think you could also let it pass you by. You know, when you have the opportunity to go, oh, yeah, I did do that. Because I think we live in regret so often. When you mention the negative moments.
Yes.
It's often tied to regret or guilt.
And missing the good stuff is one of my worst fears for my clients or for anybody, is to miss like all the great stuff about where you've been, all the wonderful, unique stuff about you that you ignore as just weird or idiosyncratic or worthless,
right.
which we do all the time.
And the thing that I was realizing, and you know, you and I have had conversations since we've gotten to know each other, and you've been very kind and gracious with your time to allow me to sort of let you know what's going on in my life. And what I realized last week is I was having my friend Dan Z, who's known me since I was 16 years old. We were in the middle of conversation about different jobs that I've had, and I've gotten myself into trouble in certain ways. And I realized it was always when I was standing up for myself, when
wow.
I wasn't going to let people get away with something. I may not have always done it the way I wish I had,
right?
But it's always been true to who I am.
Yeah.
And I just can't, I have a low tolerance for people who are unkind. And in response to that, so I was thinking about maybe some of the mistakes I've made, but I thought, no, that's who I am.
Yeah.
I just can't accept when someone is not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
What I love about listening to your story sometimes, Patty, is what you might initially say is a mistake, when you put it in context, feels like, oh, this was the only right way to go. This was, you You know, I'm really proud of that because I did stand up for who I was.
Right. And so I've looked at my entire life and I thought of moments where I've done it, whether I got into a fight in high school because a guy was picking on a kid with special needs. And I thought, no, that's who I still am.
Right.
I fight for the people who, you know, with and not for. That's the thing, too. I think that I that's what I want to work toward is fight with them instead of this idea that I'm fighting for somebody else.
Yeah.
I want to stand up with other people.
It's a pretty good motto. It's a pretty good credo to live your life by, right? I'm going to fight with these people.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't want to leave that kid alone.
Yeah.
We were all outside of Lane Tech, and this guy was smoking a cigarette, and he was picking on this kid, you know, calling him the R word, making fun of his clothes and all these things. And I said, why don't you? I said, knock it off.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it was. And he came over and started blowing smoke in my face.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I was like, okay, my dad smokes. I can take this. And then he said, my clothes are worth more than your parents paying rent, which I thought was so specific.
Super specific. not your parents' car.
No,
not right. The
but
rent.
But he was right because my parents at the time had very low rent. So
right?
I don't want to tell them, well, they only pay $175. So I don't know.
Right. Not a very impressive outfit, pal.
Yeah. So, but it was just weird. And so he said something else and then he pushed my face. He put the cigarette like next to my face and shoved my cheek. And that's when we started getting into a fight. I mean, I had played baseball. I had had fist fights with boys before that.
Yes. I don't think physically anybody was going to want to mess with you.
Well, he didn't know. And it wasn't a pretty fight. It's one of those fights where you end up with your arm in headlocks and I'm trying to like kick him from like the side, and I'm trying to kick his butt with it. It was a mess, but I realized, you know, I've thought about moments like that where I just go, well, it's just not okay. And I think that people, if I encourage you to take a look at and find those moments that go, oh yeah, that's who I am.
Yeah, I love that.
Because we forget who we are sometimes.
Yes. Yeah,
don't you think?
Yeah, I think we forget who we are all the time because of self-deprecation and because life's so busy. We don't think about who we are. We just go through motions, right? Especially once we become married and we're parents and we have kids and we have jobs and we get kind of bogged down and we forget like, oh, fundamentally, I haven't changed. I know who I am.
Yes.
And most of us, if we really give it a moment, we know who we are. We know what we're about. We could probably distill it down just like you did into less than an elevator speech, just a few words.
Right. And,
yeah.
And I think that there's something freeing in that. And you mentioned that usually we, you know, we have the breakthroughs on looking back.
Yeah.
I think it can help you feel emboldened in going forward, too.
For sure.
If you
remember who you are, it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. I like that person. You know, I don't hate who I am.
Right.
But too many of us, I think, are stuck in that kind of ongoing internal nasty dialogue.
I agree.
Yeah.
Because it's easier, I think.
I think it is easier.
I don't know about, is it easier? It's just louder.
It's loud and to the point where it becomes nearly automatic. Not quite, because I think we can interfere with it with the right intervention, just like you're talking about. But I think it takes a little intention in order to get through it.
And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about tonight was that you mentioned earlier on Bill and Wendy's show that about how important talking therapy can be for someone who's going through a traumatic situation.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people are hesitant to do that. There's a shame in it. And a lot of people feel like they don't have the resources, whether it's time or money. A lot of people, it's both.
For sure.
And I wonder if you can explain how, because people just feel kind of weird. Like, I don't want to sit down and talk to somebody. And even people who've done it have been like, well, it didn't really work for me.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's not right for you.
No, correct. So there's a couple of different points there. First off, the first therapist you sit down across from might not be the perfect match. Even if you think, this is a great person. I love this woman. I love this guy. I think I could hang out with them, but somehow we're not clicking here.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's okay. You're a consumer. You get to say, you know what? This isn't working. Do you have a referral for me? You really do get to say that.
Really?
Yeah.
The doctor that you can fire them and say, give me another one?
I insist. We all insist. We should all insist that you can fire us and you can ask for somebody else. And we should graciously say, you know what? Let me give you the name and number of somebody who I think might work better with you.
Oh, doc, I'm going to say the number's pretty high of people that won't do that. People don't even like to tell their hairdresser they don't like the style that they just gave them.
I know. I think we therapists don't do the best job of letting people know that that's an option for them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, therapy is ridiculously expensive.
Yes.
And time consuming. And to spend that time trying to either, you know, oh, I want to impress this person. I don't feel comfortable sharing my story with them. That is an absurd thing to spend your time and money and energy doing.
I think that for me, and maybe there are others out there like me, that I also, as you can tell, I'm a storyteller. And so once I sit down for an hour and unpack all of that stuff,
right,
the idea of going and realizing at some point, whether it's the second session or maybe 6 or 10 down the line, going, this isn't working for me, you're not the right person, now I gotta start and do that all over again. It's daunting too.
Well, and I don't think you have to say you're not the right person. I think you can say this isn't working. This just isn't a match for either of us, you know.
That means it's not working, Doc.
Yeah, it means but sometimes it doesn't work, and that's
okay.
That's fair. It's a chemistry experiment in a lot of ways, right? You're looking for two people to develop some degree of chemistry with one another, and sometimes that works beautifully, and some therapists are more adept at creating that space than others. But you want to find somebody that you feel really comfortable with and a space that you feel safe in.
Okay.
It's really important.
All right. Let's talk more about trying to find what's right for you, whether it's therapy.
Yeah.
But when we come back, let me know if there's any books that people, because maybe reading is a way for people to find something about themselves.
Definitely.
Or workbooks or things like that. More after this. You're listening to The Patty Vasquez Show. We are hanging out with Dr. John Duffy. He's a clinical psychologist, regular contributor here at WGN Radio. You can catch his podcast everywhere that podcasts are available. There's, okay, you have to tell me the titles again. On Purpose.
Oh, On Purpose and Better.
And Better.
On Purpose with Heidi and Better with Julie.
More with Dr. Duffy. When we come back, 312-981-7200 is our number to call or text us. 312-981-7200. Listening to the Patty Vasquez Show, we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. There are some, you know, there's some apprehension about therapy. I know that there's still a stigma attached to seeking help when maybe you're not feeling right and you're not sure what it is. Dr. John Duffy joins us in studio. He is a clinical psychologist and co-hosts the podcast Better with
my wife, Julie.
Wife, yeah. And On Purpose with Heidi Stevens, columnist for the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah.
Extraordinary writer. Just won a great award recently. I think
She won. I can't remember the name of the award.
Yeah.
She will tell you that she is the 18th most powerful woman in Chicago journalism, I believe.
Okay.
I think that's it.
There you go.
Yes.
And
I'm required to tell you that.
Oh, excellent. Now I got to find the other 17. Dr. John Duffy and I were talking about the importance of talk therapy for those who need to work through things. And we have a texter who likes to fill up the screen with a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And he is suspect of it helping anybody, or why can't people just get over it or move on? That's the tone that I'm hearing from the 312. And I thought, well, maybe some folks are comfortable reading or maybe there's workbooks. What would you suggest for people who want to find out more?
All right. So to the texter's point, a lot of people are uncomfortable, and I get it. I get that it's a very odd thing to do. And sometimes it even takes a couple hours in the room to get comfortable with it. Well, a couple of books that might help you. One of them goes back probably 25 years. It's by a brilliant psychotherapist named Irvin Yalom. It is called Lying on the Couch. It is a tremendous read. A brand new book by Lori Gottlieb is called You Should Talk to Someone. And she is a very clever writer, because she talks about being a therapist and she talks about being in therapy as a therapist. So if you want to get both points of view, she presents both. And it's light and it's humorous, but it also has the gravity to tell you, like, this is what it's like. This is where my discomfort lied. Even knowing how therapy works, she was really insecure and uncomfortable for a while in her own therapy room, like, you know, getting therapy for herself. So that's a great read. And that's a brand new book. Really great.
What would you say is the best way to get something, to get the best out of a session? Because, you know, we are talking about, first of all, because maybe that makes it helps people go into the situation feeling like they have a plan, rather than sitting down and just kind of, you know, spewing out their entire lives or all the horrible things. Or maybe some folks, it takes time to build up to that.
For sure. It's a really, really vulnerable thing to do, to go into therapy. So be prepared to ask any questions you have, and therapists will answer your questions. So if you want to know, like, how does this even work?
Right.
That's a fair question. You know, like, what do you do? How long have you been doing this? Do you work with people like me? You know what I mean? You can ask these questions like you're bringing your car into the shop. You can ask the therapist, like, you know, what? Why do I trust you? Why, you know, what have you done? And not just the things on the wall,
sure,
but like, you know, how much experience do you have? What's going to happen in here? It's okay to ask all of those questions.
Okay, I'm going to start asking.
You can ask those questions. I encourage it.
I'm trying to remember how many therapists I've had. I know I had one in high school. My dad was an alcoholic and my mom sent me to Al-Anon once. And I just cried for an hour and then I left and I was like, well, I'm not going to do that for a while. And I did it a couple times in college. I struggled. I'll tell you what I struggled with in college. I don't think I've ever talked about this on the show. So I'm going to let me do a little on-air therapy.
Here we go. Let's do it.
One of the things that I struggled with in college, I had grown up in the Mormon church. My mother had basically signed us all up to be Mormons. And I was kind of brought into it. She had made that promise to the missionaries before I was born. I feel like I should not have been grandfathered in. I was right. raised in the Mormon church, you know, very strict ideology. And, you know, so I sort of had this by the age of 10, this idea of what God was and what eternity was and all these concepts.
Sure.
And then I, for various reasons we've talked about before on the show, I don't want to go into why I stopped being a Mormon. My story is, it's true. When I was baptized, you know, you have to be of the age of reason or right. logic when you are a Mormon. And it's just you and the missionary, and he basically dunked me under the water. And I thought I was going to have this enlightened moment of feeling the Holy Spirit and right. being closer to God. And I didn't think it was going to be by near death. I thought, you got to tell a girl to hold her nose. And then he did it two more times. He dunked me under. I was, you know, and that was honestly the last day I was a Mormon. I just told my mom I didn't like it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You remember that day, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Wow. It was weird, and it just wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was, I started going to a Lutheran school, and all my friends were Lutheran. And of course, the joke I've made is that they also had really good potluck dinners, so my mom liked them too. But so I had these two religions, I had friends that were Catholic, and I would go to church with them, and I felt pretty secure in what I thought everything was about.
Yeah.
And I went to college, and I'll never forget the moment that I did not know that there were people who didn't believe in God.
I get it.
It was my boyfriend. I'd been dating this guy, and it was talking about my dog was getting older, and I was worried about her dying. And he said something like, well, what difference does it make? We're all worm meat anyway. And in a moment, like, here's somebody that I thought I loved
right.
who was saying this, like, very, and it sent me into this sort of blackness for months where I started thinking about everyone dying and the end of, you know, like, I couldn't imagine eternity. Like, I'd never thought about eternity, and it started freaking me out. And it was, so now you know that I'm not talking about somebody else. It was me who couldn't stop thinking about, I was just like trapped in this cycle. And, you know, I went to go see some, and all the questions that I got, Doc, were like, well, do you think about hurting yourself? I'm like, no, that's the last thing I want. Right. I don't want to die. That's
right, right, right.
I just can't stop. I couldn't stop thinking about everybody else dying and being without them or and it was the most. There were times when I couldn't breathe. My mom was worried about me. But that's the kind of thing. And I went to one session. I told this woman about my entire life. She's like, wow, I'm surprised you haven't killed somebody by now. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm all right.
Wow. Well, there you have it.
but for me, like when I was 20, it was real, like the therapy just didn't, I just had to kind of wait it out, but mm-hmm. those 3 months are gone.
Right.
You know, I kind of remember going, it was like being underwater.
Yeah.
What it was like.
Right. I can feel that. Oddly enough, if this really were a therapy session,
okay.
what you're doing now is exactly the right thing, right? You're kind of like, I can feel you kind of working through, this is what I believe. Then I had this moment and it absolutely shocked me and took me into this darkness.
Right.
Right. And then you started picturing like everybody around me is going to die. Like, what's that mean now? So all of a sudden this existential fear grips you. Totally understandable, right? I mean, you know, like, and so to have somebody reflect to you like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense, you know? And then to kind of like reframe now, okay, so now what do you believe? What do you want to do going forward?
Yes,
now that you have this new point of view in your vernacular, what now? You know what I mean? And then the idea of therapy would be, let's assimilate all this so that you don't feel like hurting yourself or anybody else.
Right. And I never did. It was never that kind of a thing. It was so funny. I kind of remember being a little bit cynical when she asked me about that. And then I had one therapist that started talking about angels, and I was like, oh, you're just crazy. I'm going to go. But there are
all kinds of therapists out there, really.
But I also think that I was resistant. But even like telling you about it, like I can feel my skin start to burn because
it's palpable.
Yeah, I was. I just remember like I could darkness. That's all I could feel.
Well, if you that's so terrifying to think about. Like I find at this point in my life, I had this realization, and I'd never thought about that before. I can imagine that was terrifying.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was bad. I was dating the guy. He came to Chicago to go to the World Cup with my mom, and my mom was worried. She's like, she thought that there was something wrong with me. So they're at the World Cup together. My dad and I are at the racetrack, and I remember because I was sitting on a bench just watching people walk by, thinking they're gonna die. It was really bad, and I was not able to talk. And this happened when Declan was born too. When he was born, I just remember everything was painful.
Yeah.
My mom came home. Okay, I don't think I've ever told the story on the air. I hope my mom doesn't get mad. So my mom follows
me. It's okay.
Me.
It's confidential.
My mom follows me into the bathroom, and I'm going. I'm on the potty, right? And my mom comes and sits down in front of me. She puts her. I'm on the. It's the weirdest thing.
You're seated. I'm seated.
Yeah. And she goes, Patricia, tell me the truth. Are you pregnant? And I was like, no, I'm afraid there's no God. And she goes, I swear. She goes, oh, there isn't.
Oh, my God.
I was like, what? Wait, what? I had no idea. I mean, it was bad enough here. I was like, what? And in the meantime, by the way, she's come around. She's like, what? I'm agnostic, just in case I'm covering my bases. More after this on 720 WGN.
Wow.
Hey, everybody. Doc, we are, it's funny because my producer said you got about a minute and a half, and then you and I continued our therapy session. There are folks who are letting us know that we are not on the live stream, so we're trying to figure that out. So our apologies. And if you, by the way, if you miss anything, though, and you want to hear about my 3 months of despair, that one time, you can find everything podcast on WGNradio.com and anywhere podcasts are available. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Duffy when we come back after the news. 312-981-7200. All right, my therapy session's over, Doc. I got that off my chest. I don't think I've ever talked about my dark period during college.
It was an interesting session. It was interesting to get to know you there.
Dr. John Duffy joins us in studio. He is a clinical psychologist and co-host of the podcast with his wife, Better.
Yes.
And also with Heidi Stevens on the podcast On Purpose.
I just can't stop yammering on the podcast.
Hey, right? I'm with you. Earlier, someone was like, could you stop talking? I want to hear the doctor. Okay, it's his turn again. We have a listener from the 779 says that they're enjoying the show. So thank you very much, 779. 301, thank you so much, Paul, for your condolences. My dad's best friend, his lifelong friend, who I consider to be my uncle, passed away earlier this week. And Desi O'Neill was a former president of the Chicago Firefighters Union back, I think, like in the 80s, maybe late 70s. Yeah, Desi O'Neill.
Oh, so sorry, Patty.
He was such an incredible,
amazing guy.
Such a great guy. 312, I'm so glad that you can hear us now. They say I may continue to work. Thank you very much.
It's good to have permission.
And we've been talking about going into therapy. Dr. John Duffy is a clinical psychologist, and we often talk a little bit about what it's like to be a client, someone that comes in, and what to expect, and how to ask questions when it comes to your own care. And I do love the questions from the 815 about nutrition. We spoke earlier, Doc, about how your nutrition can affect your mental status.
For sure.
And so this is a longer one, but let me see if I can, I think, do you want me to read the longer one?
Absolutely, let's go through it.
From the 815, this is a fascinating topic. We had a family member who definitely deprived themselves of food, so nutrition was deficient. In my opinion, that affected the chemical balance in their mind. Intervention was sought, and while under hospital observation, she was diagnosed schizophrenic. The problem I saw was that because of the nutritional and chemical deficiency, the subject was unable to realize with any degree whatsoever of their, I guess, underlying illness is what we're saying.
Yep.
It is very sad to witness. So the million-dollar question is, how can we convince anyone who doesn't trust us mentally, right? So then now they're suspicious of you, compounded by their fears, anxieties.
Yeah.
How do you convince them to eat as a means to also get better, to become healthy? not only physically, but mentally?
It's a great question. And the first issue has to be physical health when it comes to nutrition, because we have to eat. And so if you find that your loved one truly is unable to realize that he or she is suffering from this nutrition eating issue, and they can't find their compass of reason, then you almost have to get them involved in a hospitalization or partial hospitalization program, part of which is really nutrition based, like behaviorally based, like, you know, and teaching them, reteaching them. And sometimes as adults, we need to be retaught this. You need this many calories to do this. Once that's achieved, then you can go to an outpatient therapist, and then you can get down to the why. Once they find their compass of reason, right. And this is the great part to me of treating like an eating disorder or virtually any emotional disorder, and even eating disorders, as behavioral as they may seem, their core is emotional. And so once you get the eating part under control enough, you can work with a therapist, either outpatient or inpatient, and really get down to, like, what is it that you're trying to control here so desperately in your life? Or what area of your life lacks control to the extent that you're willing to compromise your own safety here in order to maintain control over something? And a lot of people in the wake of an eating problem would say, oh, yeah, you know, part of the reason I do that or did that is I wanted control. And this was the only area of my life I knew I could control. I could control what I put in my body.
And the awareness of it, too, is that sometimes people don't even realize that that's what they're doing. The why of it becomes masked, obviously.
Right. And the awareness is compounded by something called dysmorphia, which you've probably heard about, where somebody might look in the mirror and be literally, like, you know, super, super thin and fit and see something else, see that they are heavy, see that they are, you know, a very, very different, and literally see something different than you might see looking at them in the mirror.
I have another one I used to do when made fun of me when I was like 12 or 13 for having a mustache, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden that was all I could, and it lasted for years. Whenever I would look in the mirror, all I could see was like this little peach fuzz on my lip or like the sideburns, but to the point where any chance I had, I would pull the hair out of my arms or my hand. Like if I saw any hair, I could.
And so that generalized.
And my mom's hearing this for the first time, I think, too.
No kidding.
Yeah, I never, and like every, like I would, if I was sitting by myself, and like I would have tweezers to pull it out, like anywhere I could find it. I would, you know, from my legs, my arms. I wouldn't pull it out of my head.
That right?
I always had very nice hair.
Yeah, there you go.
But I couldn't, like, in the mirrors, I just, you know, especially if we had those magnifying ones, and then they're teenagers. This happens where teenagers like pick at like the pores and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's because you're seeing something, you're locking into something, right? And is that anxiety as well?
It absolutely is anxiety. And right, we tend to focus on these perceived flaws and just stare at them.
Oh.
And they grow and they morph. And usually it has to do with something other than that. But it's hard to convince somebody in real time who's concerned, like, I think I have this mustache, or I think I'm heavier. Or I've worked with somebody recently who had what I would call age dysmorphia, where he really felt like, I think I look 30 years older than I am. And he meant it, you know.
Yeah.
And so when he looked in a mirror, he was convinced I look like an old man, and he was like 35 years old. And that's all an artifact of something going on psychological.
Yeah. 312-981-7200. I want to let people know that they can call or text, because I'm unpacking my whole bag. But these are things that throughout my life that I've, you know, gone through these periods. But if you ever see me do this, like that, I'm feeling that, like, if there's a little bit of fuzz on
Is that right?
I don't pull it out, as you know. Once in a while, I'll catch myself like feeling the fuzz somewhere on the back of my hand or on my. Because I remember, it doesn't even on my arms. It doesn't grow back as well. I used to have much more.
Is that right?
I just could not stand it.
Well, and most of us, if we have something like that, it tends to become something that we can live with, something adaptive and or not altogether maladaptive. And it's like, okay, I can live with this degree, because most of us, if the spectrum are wide enough. Most of us are obsessive and compulsive and depressed and anxious and all of that stuff. Just we can function pretty well. And it sounds like you found your degree of functioning pretty well.
It lasted, I mean, in a very intense way, I would say, from when I was 12 till somewhere in college. I don't know when. I think, you know, maybe it was someone, because you don't realize you're doing it anymore.
Yep.
Right? It's not like you sit down and go, oh, now I'm going to pull the hair out of my arms.
And were you, can I ask, you hiding it in real time, or was it pretty apparent, or do you think
I would be on a bus.
Tell?
I remember being on the 68 Northwest Highway bus and, like, you know, have my hand on the railing and be like, oh, there's I'm going to get rid of that hair.
No kidding. Yeah, okay, no, so you weren't hiding it at all.
I don't think so. Yeah. No, I would often, like, it doesn't grow back on my elbows.
Right.
Took care of that when I was 15 years old, apparently. Wow, I feel like telling you everything. Listeners are like, well, this is too much, Patty, too much. Close the hose. The 312 wants to know if you had a police officer in your family. Did you have was your dad a cop?
My dad was not a cop. I have done a lot of consulting with different police departments about what I was talking about with Bill and Wendy, what we were talking about earlier, their post-traumatic reactions and how to handle the subsequent emotions. So I'd be curious to know what the origin of that question is, but no, I do not have.
They were wondering if your dad was a Chicago police lieutenant.
I would imagine that
Duffy's a good Irish name.
A good number of Duffys who are. So I'm going to say one of my uncles probably. Yep.
The 815 thanks you for your answer and comments earlier about nutrition and kind of wanting to be able to unearth what's an underlying issue. But they also mentioned, and this would go to what I was talking about when it came to when I was in grade school, notice being made fun of for something physically. I can't imagine, as 815 mentions, on top of that, with today's social media and how much self-awareness is even more, what did you call it, dimorphic?
Dysmorphia.
Dysmorphia.
Yeah.
I wonder, this is going to be a time in history where we look back and try to figure out, you know, how many more sort of how mental issues were compounded by having it, whether it's conversation or the way we attack each other or pictures or things that we, you know, all these different elements.
So much self-esteem issues for kids really get struck by social media. A harrowing story of a girl I worked with, she showed me the selfie. She would take about 200 selfies a day from a certain angle. Then she would doctor them. This would take about an hour in order to put it on Instagram. So she would doctor her waist size and her bust size and her hair and her teeth. And I remember her saying, I look pretty cute, right? And oh, sure. And she said, but it doesn't look anything like me, but watch this. And she posted it, and the likes just started coming one after another until she had about 1,100 of them by the end of the session. And she said, I know that this is all BS. I know that there's nothing really going on here, but I need this for my self-esteem.
Yes. And that's something that, okay, now we have there is that moment where when you start getting that, it's feeding something.
Yes,
that pleasure chemical in your brain. You're like, oh, they like another person.
It's like the casino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
312-981-7200. Give us a call or text us. And the 312 says, I enjoy the station and radio show too. They were the ones that asked about your dad, if your dad was a copper. Is his dad a copper? Oh, no, that's another one. Well, okay. People are enjoying the show.
I was going to have my dad back off and, like, don't show up at the house.
312-981-7200. Thank you so much for all these great texts. We'd love to hear from you as well. Give us a call or text us. We'll be back in a moment on WGN 720.
Right.
We're live in the outside. You know, I can say it on the air. Maybe I'll say it on the air. I don't know. Dr. John Duffy in studio with us. He's a clinical psychologist, and we're talking about how to be to get the most out of therapy and why it can work for you. I get that it's not going to work for some folks. We mentioned some books earlier. If you could tell folks again what the names of those books were.
Lying on the Couch by Irvin Yalom, and You Should Talk to Somebody. You Should Talk to Someone by Lori Gottlieb.
And
great books.
Might be a good place to start to find out why talk therapy might work for you. It's certainly some place if you feel like you're in a cycle of, you know, if you're especially just the idea if you have the sensation of I'm trapped or I can't let go of this thought, something that's weighing you down or holding you back. You know, if you have the opportunity to see somebody, try to, or perhaps pick up one of these books from the library.
Yep. and just get started that way.
Get started.
Yeah.
I stop and go. I stop and go with therapy. I haven't been in probably about 4 years, and I've asked you for recommendations, yeah, and you have pointed me in the right direction, and then it's following through. And, you know, people come up with excuses. It, like any other health issue, we come up with excuses not to take care of ourselves, don't
Absolutely.
We
postpone. And therapy's an easy one, right? Because it's not like, you know, a gallbladder or something. It's not, or your a heart attack. You can put off therapy for a really long time, but I find that a lot of people come to me wishing they had come sooner because they feel like, oh, I missed some years, or I spent too much time worrying about something and I didn't need to worry about it all that time. So I wasted this time.
Well, let's talk about that, actually. Yeah. How do you, you know, the idea of wasted time, and I've talked about one of the nurses that helped save Declan's life.
Yeah.
You know, when I started worrying, oh, what did I do wrong? Was it my fault? One of the things that always stays with me, and it's hard to come back to, which is that regret is a wasted emotion.
Yes.
And worrying that maybe you should have done, or I wish I had done something, that's another thing that can really consume you, isn't it?
It is, and there aren't many emotions that I want to discount and say, I don't think that's useful to spend a lot of time on. Worry is one of them, right? You mm-hmm. know, worrying about what's coming, worrying about what's already happened.
Right.
We arrive at this point in life for a reason, and you know what therapy can help you do is kind of determine that reason and give you the comfort to move forward.
Okay.
You know, and the you used the word resilience earlier, the resilience and the competence to move forward.
And resilience is something that I think people see in others and don't think they have. But right. We are all, I think, imbued with resilience.
I think we're all incredibly resilient. What we're not great always at testing that, and we make this assumption of we can't. Oh, I couldn't do that. I couldn't possibly. Or
right.
That's for other people. And a lot of therapy is encouraging people to shift what are the age-old beliefs about themselves to something more productive and adaptive and forward-thinking and progressive, you know?
And I think that if we can find those moments where we were resilient, like find out what it was that got us through it, you know, and kind of figure out a way to at least acknowledge it and honor it by finding other ways, other moments to be that person.
And I think, right, I agree completely. And we have to recognize we've all been through something. You know, a lot of people will discount like, I had this tough time when I was in college, but other people have suffered more. And when we dismiss our suffering, we're not honoring it in a very good way.
Yes.
And we're not giving ourselves license then to move forward. We're saying, I don't deserve to feel the way I feel. And that's a non-starter. That kind of gets us stuck in our tracks, you know? So I think we need to give ourselves permission to feel what we feel and to recognize, oh, I have made it through some tough times, so I can make it through some more.
Yeah. Give yourself a ribbon for that. Whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Y'all get it. Everybody gets a little credit for that.
Then we're not talking about like, you get a ribbon, but, you know, find a way to identify the things that you are proud of too. Maybe that's one thing, one way to put it. By the way, this is a good question because I don't think that we have covered, I don't know if we've ever covered this. We talk about how you're a clinical psychologist.
Yeah.
And a listener from the 847 is wondering differences, the distinction between psychologists, clinical psychologists, maybe psychiatrists too, if you want to throw that one in there.
Yeah, sure. There are so many mental health designations that it gets dizzying. So starting with psychiatrists are prescribing doctors. So if you find that like I am so depressed or so anxious, my attention issues are so profound, I need medication, a psychiatrist is where you want to start, right? Psychologists are, we do treatment. We sit down one-on-one or in groups and we do therapy with people. That's by and large what psychologists do. Psychologists also do research in, you know, academic settings.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are licensed clinical social workers who are also typically amazing therapists, and sometimes LPNs. And there's a number of designations that can be really good therapists. What I encourage people to do is not focus too much on the couple of letters following the name. Mine is PsyD, and there are PhD and LCPC and LPN. There's all sorts of different designations for therapists. Find somebody who has the experience that matches you and that you like. And trust.
And so when you're online, because look, I'll tell you how I picked my OBGYN.
Yeah.
I really liked her smile. And she ended up not only being a wonderful doctor, so was everybody else in her practice. I got lucky. But yeah. That can't be the way you pick all your doctors.
No.
It's also, I was on a website, and so I go through and I try to figure out, okay, they talk about, you know, we work with folks who are suffering from PTSD or sexual violence, you know, all these different things.
Specialties, yeah.
Right. And you try to, it becomes overwhelming to kind of cut through all that clutter.
It's so difficult. I mean, you know, sometimes people will, if I'm giving a talk, will come up and just say, here's what I'm dealing with. Where do I even start in finding that therapist, right? So one way to do it is if you know a therapist, talk to them about, you know, because we usually know a network of people, right?
Sure.
Your primary care doctor undoubtedly has therapists that they refer to. If it's for your child, the school social worker, the school psychologist will know somebody that they can refer you to. You know,
it's not like the city's paying for a school psychologist. I don't know. I don't know what neighborhood you're
where
living
am I coming
in.
From
the social. Ro, did you hear this? There's schools with clinical psychologists or psychologists that work at. Did you have a psychologist at your school?
We had counselors.
Yeah. Did you really?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. See, I didn't go talk to my counselors. Maybe that was part of the
most
problem.
Most people do not. Most people do not make use of school counselors, but they're a really good resource. And
that's
they're
a good point.
For you. Yeah.
Did you talk to your counselors, Ro, when you were in school?
Sometimes.
You're like,
That seems like a good thing, Ro.
I'll say this. When it comes to the high school that I went to, it took me quite a while to get adjusted to it because I was a transplant. So, you know, we moved.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anybody. I didn't want to be in this district. I wanted to be back with my friends. But towards my junior year, things got a little ruffled. I got really busy and I was working and I was just really confused on like what adulthood is supposed to be. So that was
still confused.
You know what? I still don't totally get it. I don't think there's any rules to this.
No, just nonsense. Yeah.
I went to talk to my counselor. I think we would talk twice a week for my entire junior year, actually, and then once every so often during my senior year. But that was the first time. But I will say this beforehand, I have had, I don't want to call them therapists, but like, you need to sit down and have counseling sessions with your reverend and things like that.
Right.
My mom did put my sister and I through that, me, her, and my
mom.
Oh,
boy.
Yeah, it was interesting.
That's intense. You mean intense?
Yes.
Yes. We are going to continue our conversation. Let's take a break here. Coming up is the news. We are hanging out with Dr. John Duffy, 312-981-7200. If you want to give us a call or text, a lot of texts. I'm not surprised. A lot of times, folks, you know, they want to listen and hang back.
Yeah.
And we appreciate you joining our conversation tonight. And you're welcome to call as well. 312-981-7200. More in a moment. Some good mellow music. Maybe you're rolling on the highways across the country. I want to say hi to all of our trucker friends out there. We got Trucker Rich, Trucker Jamie. I know there's a lot more of you out there, but those are our friends that chime in all the time. And Dr. John Duffy in studio with us, and we are talking about talk therapy. It was something that you talked with Bill and Wendy about, and the importance of following up immediately after a traumatic incident.
Yes.
And I found that fascinating as well, that you really need to address something when it's a teenager or a child.
Right. Yeah. If you've been through or your child has been through anything traumatic, and the bar is surprisingly low when it comes to trauma, we're finding they need to talk to somebody very quickly about that, even if that's just a parent, to tell the story of what happened. Because if they don't, symptoms tend to set in really quickly. Like, and the bar is about 3 days on the long end. And if it's any longer than that, kids become anxious, depressed, and otherwise symptomatic. They can't sleep and they get nightmares and kids in particular. And I've worked with a number of kids who have had varying degrees of trauma, from fender benders to, I had mentioned this morning, a boy who had inadvertently paralyzed another boy on the ice playing hockey.
Right. And that was, my husband and I were talking about it after that conversation. We were struck by, you know, how horrifying it would be, one, to be that kid. And then everyone was cheering.
Yep.
And so to realize, so not just the kid that had been involved in the accident, but also everyone around, because then you do start telling, yourself a story.
Right.
You know, what are the stories we're telling ourselves is one of the most incredible things, too. I don't think we realize, because sometimes you don't realize that's not what's happening, right? That it was an accident. It wasn't his fault. They weren't cheering that he was paralyzed. Like all these different things, you start telling yourself a story,
right?
And that becomes your reality.
And what looked like was happening probably in the stands that day was not at all what was going on.
Right.
Yeah.
That's you're right not, about that's that. That's not what's happening.
Right. And so these kids also had to deal with those competing narratives.
Yes.
Especially about either them being villains or the kid that got hurt being a villain, you know, which neither of which is really true. None of these kids are bad kids. They're playing hockey. And there was this unfortunate, horribly unfortunate moment that is kind of lifelong. And I cannot describe for you the trauma that these kids were going through, and the coaches. It had ripple effects. The parents, some of the siblings of these kids were shattered. So it's kind of like you get this center of the target, but there's these ripple effects going all the way out to people who weren't even in the arena.
It's one of those things that it's hard to say, hey, if something bad happens, you go see somebody.
Oh yeah,
because there's
way
so many
more
other...
complex than that.
It is.
Yeah.
But if you can have the presence of mind, and I've been in several accidents. I apparently have a target on the back of my car, and I wish that I had gone and talked to somebody about it, because I was nearly killed by a guy who fell asleep behind the wheel of his Porsche Cayenne. Ivan, how are you doing?
Hey, Patty.
Hello. What do you want? I'm gonna go back and forth a little bit on this because I'm getting an echo. Can I ask you a quick question, Ivan?
Yeah.
Are you on a landline?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm proving a theory. Excellent. All right.
What's your theory?
My theory is that people who call us on landlines, we get an echo. So some people might think you still have your radio on, but it is a direct echo. It's not like the delay.
Well, usually it's the other way around. It's been my experience.
Isn't that weird?
Cell phones suck.
I know. I think ever since we moved into the studio, we have had some trouble with landlines. So I was just checking.
Well, anyway.
Yes, go ahead. What do you want to ask?
Yes, sir. Doctor?
Yes, sir.
I have a 40-year-old son who's mentally ill.
Yeah.
I have recently, I think I saw a TED Talk a couple of days ago, and I've saw a couple other YouTube videos.
Mm-hmm.
About psychedelics.
Right.
What's your thoughts?
Well, they're starting to do some research in the States that's been going on in Europe for a very long time on microdosing certain psychedelic medication and testing that out on mental illness. And they're, from what I understand, and I've read quite a bit about this, I'm not a prescribing doc, so I'm going to give you my thoughts, but not necessarily a professional opinion, but... what I'm reading suggests that they are running into a pretty impressive degree of success. What they're struggling with, from what I can tell, Ivan, is dosing these medications. So people are not used to kind of specifically dosing those psychedelic meds into something that is something like 1/100th of what you would take if you were looking to trip, as they say, on some of these meds. There is a new med on the market called ketamine that has been in Europe for years, and I know that people are running into some success with that when it comes to depression in particular, anxiety as well. So there are some new medications out there to look into that, to your point, are not conventional, not normally what we'd be looking at if we were looking for something to treat some kind of mental disorder, especially if your 40-year-old son has run into problems with some of the more conventional treatment plans.
That makes sense.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Right, yeah. My son's on several drugs, you know. He's been on them since he became mentally ill when he was 16. Yeah, so are you aware of any clinical trials around here, around Chicago?
Are you? I know that we have, you know, on the station we have talked about ketamine, and we have a doctor that we've talked to frequently. Are you in the Chicagoland area?
Yeah, Bartlett.
The thing about the treatments here, I think that they're not yet covered by insurance. Is
correct.
That your understanding?
Absolutely. They're very much in trials. Yes.
Yeah. So, costs a lot of dough.
I don't know about that.
And there are some clinics around the city that are where you can get ketamine treatments. But I think some of them are expensive because I think Patty's right that by and large, this is not yet in the state of Illinois anyway, covered very well by insurance companies. But I suspect at some point in the not too distant future, it will be.
And Dr. Nandra is the doctor that we've talked to here at WGN. I think it's IV Solutions. But it's N-A-N-D-R-A if you want to.
N-A-N-V-R-A.
It's a D. N as in Nancy, A, Apple, N, Nancy. D as in David. R as in radio. And A as in Apple. Nandra.
Nandra Solutions?
IV Solutions.
IV. Mm-hmm. Solutions. All right.
That's one of them, and I know that if once you Google that, you might find his mother.
Certainly.
So, yeah.
You know, take a look.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
I'm just trying to investigate this, so.
Oh, no doubt. I know you're trying to find some answers.
I turned on the radio and heard you. Well, I was listening to the White Sox.
Gotcha. Well, we wish you the best of luck, Ivan.
Good luck, Ivan.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you. Wish you and your son well. That's the thing, is that, you know, it's, oh man, you know, having a kid that you want to do everything for them, find all your options.
You really do, and you can feel somebody like Ivan working so hard. And by my math, his son has been on medication since he was 16 years old. He's 40 now. That's a long time to be guiding somebody through all this.
Well, I mean, you know, mental health is a lifelong journey as well for anybody, whether you are able to seek help, whether, you know, maybe you're going along thinking you're fine, check in with yourself, you know, maybe journal.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a big fan.
Yeah. I think write some stuff down. Will you come see us again in a few weeks?
Absolutely. Are you kidding?
I appreciate that. Thank you for joining us for Wellness Wednesday.
Thanks for having me.
It was outstanding. Let's get a picture.
Let's get a picture.
We should get coffee sometime. I swear I'll stop treating it like it's a therapy session. We are going to talk to Renato Mariotti when we come back, CNN legal analyst. You might have heard him earlier on Ro Khan's show, and I wanted to have him back. More in a moment. You're listening to The Patty Vasquez Show. We are in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Pretty remarkable day when it comes to national. And actually, I think this counts as international news because there's an entire industry built around the Mueller investigation. Renato Mariotti joins me in studio. He is a former federal prosecutor, a practicing attorney, and CNN legal analyst. And you didn't know this was going to happen. Did anyone know? Did anyone tell you later, hey, Renato, I saw this coming, but I couldn't say anything?
No one told me that. In fact, so I saw I saw some announcements on Twitter this morning, less than an hour before it happened, that Mueller was going to be making a statement. I'll confess, I was meeting a friend for brunch, and it's like, oh no, I guess I'm.
You're like, I'm on the clock all of a sudden.
I got there and I told him I'm going to have to listen and to this statement before we have our brunch because. We got to do this. You know, it's interesting. Journalists were pretty in the dark too. I was communicating with some journalists in that hour beforehand. You know, asking questions. You know, they were asking me if I'd be available for comment and this and that. And I said, well, what are you hearing? Is this just him debunking some rumor from this Wolf book or this and that? And they knew very vague things about the statement, and that was it.
So when the statement was, came, because I actually missed it.
Okay.
I got the texts and tweets afterwards. I arise early. I go to bed early. No, wait, early in the morning. So late to everybody else. To you, it's late. To me, it's 5 or 6 in the morning. So if I can get 6 or 7 hours of sleep in, wow. I'm happy. I don't get alerts when, hey, Mueller's going to have a press conference. What did you think when you saw him deliver that statement behind the podium in front of the Department of Justice like logo?
I got to say, my expectations for the Mueller statement are different than almost everyone listening to this. And I had very limited expectations or low expectations of what I expected from Robert Mueller. I thought he was going to get up there and say very little. And he actually was up there talking for longer than I expected him to. I thought that he was going to say almost nothing beyond what he said in his report, and that was certainly accurate. But he definitely revealed a few things that were interesting. I thought, it was very interesting that he talked about his desire not to testify further, that his report was the testimony. I think that appears to be a primary purpose or one of the many purposes or key purposes of his statement. Another appeared to be to emphasize certain portions of his report, sentences from his report that he thought had been distorted, potentially by Attorney General Barr and others of the president's allies. So I thought it was interesting. I did learn some things from it, but you know, anyone going up there and expecting Bob Mueller to make news and make a lot of pointed statements is just doesn't understand the kind of person that he is.
I was expecting his voice to be a little more gravelly. I'll be honest with you. I was expecting it. But it was an interesting moment in time. A lot of people were hoping for something definitive. I think that is across the board on either side. As it is, everyone's running with their interpretation of, if I was confident that he didn't commit a crime, I would have said so. I believe that's, am I paraphrasing, or is that basically what he said?
Yeah, I mean, basically what he said, right, is that he was precluded by this Department of Justice policy from charging the president, and so he thought it would be unfair for him to pass a judgment on the president. But if he could exonerate him, he would have done that, and he couldn't.
He couldn't, in the sense that he, based on the evidence, he could not exonerate him.
Correct.
Okay.
And I think, you know, he did in the report really go further than that in a number of spots. I mean, he went, essentially said, okay, here's the elements of obstruction of justice, and as to this episode, there's substantial element of the first and the second and the third elements. Well, any lawyer, even probably knowledgeable person, could see, okay, that appears to be that amounts to obstruction of justice. Then, you know, he did not highlight that in the statement. I really think that in many ways his statement could have gone a lot worse for President Trump.
Yes, I think so
a
too.
Lot worse. Right. So I think, you know, he is really trying to walk a tightrope here and make no statement that can get pulled out and turned into a soundbite that can be seen as helping one party or another. He's trying to stay within his lane as much as he possibly can. And I don't think that most lawyers would have taken that approach, but I expected him to take an approach like that, because the federal prosecutors that I used to work with that had been in that office, been working as federal prosecutors for decades, people like Pat Fitzgerald, they were that sort of cautious, careful type who have been trained over many years not to say much publicly about ongoing investigations, and when an investigation goes public, to be very measured in your comments. And I think what Robert Mueller said was consistent with that approach. What I think it highlights is how Attorney General Barr's handling of all this is so outside the box and so unusual and so not comporting with Justice Department policy and practice.
And when you say that it's not the policy of the department to make a decision, and well, to indict the president of the United States, a lot of people were wondering, and I saw this on your Twitter feed, about policy, rules, and constitutionality of this. Mm-hmm. What is the distinction? I mean, policy, is that you're encouraged not to indict, or is it a rule? And where does the Constitution land on this?
Great question. So the Justice Department's a large organization and has lawyers that are specialized in all sorts of different things. There's a group of lawyers called the Office of Legal Counsel who are essentially the lawyers' lawyers. In other words, they are the lawyers for the lawyers of the Justice Department answering difficult legal questions. And they have decided that the Constitution dictates that the sitting president can't be indicted. There's a difference of opinion on that. There are people who disagree. There's a debate about the subject. But that's been the Justice Department's view during the Nixon era and during the Clinton era. Now, you could, some people might observe, some of our listeners might say, well, of course, the Justice Departments of these presidents who could be indicted are coming to that conclusion. And it's an excellent point. But the bottom line is that has been the policy for a long time. Robert Mueller was bound by that view of the Constitution. And so today he said it would have been unconstitutional for him under that policy to have indicted a sitting president. And so he made the decision not to go down that road at all and make any kind of judgment. And that's an extreme extraordinary and a very unusual decision on his part.
And of course, there's a lot of clamoring out there for then Congress to take this up. He said in his statements, this is Congress's responsibility now, although people still would have liked for him to say, based on what I have learned, Congress has a lot of standing here to go forward with impeachment. My question is, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with, because I don't know the history of this particular an investigation on the president. Did the investigator during Nixon administration tell Congress, based on what I've learned, this is why you should impeach and that's why they moved forward? Or are you familiar at all?
Yeah, there were findings that were made, factual findings, but ultimately it was a Watergate. There was actually a committee in Congress that was formed, mm-hmm. that investigated the matter, and ultimately they are the ones who generated articles of impeachment. So it really was less driven by a special counsel than it is. Although there was very famously Leon Jaworski who was investigating this matter and was Nixon wanted to fire, but it was less driven by that than Mueller today. It was not the Jaworski investigation in the way that there was a Mueller investigation today.
And there was a bipartisan movement as well at the time. There were people on both sides of the aisle who wanted to know more, wanted to get to the truth.
Well, what I would say is, first of all, you had Congress controlled by large majorities by the Democrats, okay. in both the House and the Senate. That's one big difference. In other words, if Chuck Schumer was the Senate Majority Leader and there were substantial majorities in both houses of Congress, that the Democrats had, that would be a different thing. And I think then in that era, it is certainly the case that party and partisanship was not at the level that it was today. And part of that is because the parties did not match up on liberal conservative lines that they do now. In other words, there were a lot of Southern conservative Democrats at the time, and there were right. Northeastern liberal Republicans. And so there were a lot of bipartisan wranglings and bipartisan coalitions in Congress at that time.
Before we go to the break, I want to ask you something. Well, you know what? Let's take a break here. And I have, you know what? I teased you. I said I was only going to ask you about one more issue, uh-huh. but I think I have to ask you about two, because Louisiana today did pass legislation that's going to go to the governor that they also will not allow abortions past 6 weeks. I want to ask you about the race to the Supreme Court across the country. I also want to ask you about comments by Mitch McConnell today that should there be another vacancy on the Supreme Court, that he would, of course, then appoint a new justice as opposed to what happened last time when Merrick Garland was nominated. Let's find out more in a moment. We're talking to Renato Mariotti, CNN legal analyst and Chicago lawyer and a former federal prosecutor. More after this on 720 WGN. You are listening to the Patty Vasquez Show, and there's so much legal stuff going on around the country. We are grateful here at WGN Radio to speak with CNN legal analyst, former federal prosecutor, and practicing attorney Renato Mariotti. You might have heard him earlier on Ro Khan's show, but I know that you focused, as we spoke a moment ago, about Ken Mueller's statements and his press conference, which was surprising to many people. What's not surprising now, after about a week and a half, 2 weeks of legislatures, particularly in the South, and obviously a lot of red states, Missouri, Alabama, Georgia, Ohio's making strides, and Louisiana today passed legislation banning abortions after 6 weeks. You and I have spoken to some experts about this and what it means. I have a question for you, and I know this isn't your area of expertise, but I was wondering, because one thing, what are your thoughts when people say it's okay, abortion is okay if it's the result of rape and incest? So then they're saying it's murder in those cases, but not in these, which I think is obviously, thankfully, there's some place where women who are victims aren't further victimized. But what does that mean legally to say in one instance, a 6 week fetus or embryo actually is if you terminate the pregnancy, that's murder, but in others it doesn't because of the instance in which the embryo is inseminated?
It's definitely an unusual position, let's just put it that way. In other words, the position, just to kind of break down what you said a moment ago, the position of certain folks who are anti-reproductive rights, anti-abortion rights, is that, well, a fetus is a human being, and so therefore, I think, as you're suggesting, Patty, that aborting a fetus is equivalent of murdering a human being. If that's the case, that, if someone's been raped or the victim of incest, by that logic, this fetus is still a human being, is an innocent person. They're not the person committing incest or rape. So why would you be able to retaliate against them, a third party, for right. the actions of the rapist or the person committing incest?
This is tough. I understand it. But even people who are who want to get rid of abortion, which is not possible, abortion will never end. It's something that women have done for centuries since they were able to make choices. Even animals in the wild do this. So yes, what I'm saying is, if illegally, is there ever an instance where this is murder, but this isn't, even though it's the parallels?
It's a great question. I mean, here's the short answer. You know, it can be self-defense to if somebody, you know, and this is, I saw Chris Christie question on this point, of course, as a lawyer himself, a former federal sure. prosecutor. And he said, well, it's self-defense in his mind.
So but terminating the pregnancy means it's self-defense so that the woman is no longer attacked by her attacker because the embryo is the result of the attack.
I guess, but the embryo is not the attacker, right? So, right. In other words, if I try to assault you, you can use force to protect yourself against me, but using force against a third party is weird. It's almost like I'm throwing another person at you and mm-hmm. you're going to injure. I guess that must be their argument. I'm trying to be as charitable as possible.
Well, they are, because in Alabama, they are considering third, they must be, because they're also saying that they are a citizen, which must be slippery territory for them, because then if an undocumented, illegal, alien, whatever they want to terminate, somebody who's here illegally gets pregnant, here they would be a citizen of Alabama, and so the fetus would be a citizen, but not the host, which would be the mom. I mean, this is what the states are asking, is for women to be incubators. Because here's the extrapolation of all this, right? A couple things. One, mm-hmm. if it's murder, then it must be prosecuted at the same level as murder. Why would they not prosecute a woman who terminates a pregnancy at the same level as murder if they are now criminalizing abortion as murder?
So it's an interesting question. It's essentially what they're saying is that a fetus doesn't have the same standing as an ordinary person, right? Or that it somehow that crimes against the fetus are of lesser than a crime against a human being. And if a fetus was able to bring a legal challenge, I suppose someone could on behalf of the fetus, if the fetus has rights under this scenario that you're talking about, which is all, what does that, once again, not my view. I want to make this crystal clear.
I know, we're doing, what I'm trying
to... You're asking
me
to defend views I do not agree with. So,
well, that's sort of what you do in law school, isn't it? Here's these,
that
you
is
know,
true.
This philosophy, this law, we're working on logic. I'm trying to go with the logic.
I just want to make that clear for everybody here. So I guess you would have an equal protection challenge. The fetus would say that I don't have equal rights to a person. The reason I'm adding this is because people could take things out of context or...
No, I appreciate that. And they're going to, they'll be driving along, turn the radio on and hear Patty talking about how if a woman is attacked, she should not be able to protect herself from right. and she should have some obviously individual control over her life. So so we're talking in extrapolating from the logic that seems to be part of this legislation. So my other question then, because I know that this I've lured you into this conversation,
sure.
but the other thing is, you know, pregnancy does not come without risks to a woman.
Sure.
There is gestational diabetes, there's high blood pressure, there's preeclampsia, there are infections. Some women die in childbirth. So if a woman who has been forced to carry on a pregnancy dies, can her family then sue the state for having enforced a pregnancy, forcing her to remain pregnant when she otherwise would have she wouldn't have died?
Yeah, it's interesting. What I would say is I don't think that she could. It's interesting. You're saying, would she sue them for damages?
Not her, her family, because she would be dead.
Or potentially she was just injured, let's just say herself, but yeah, or her estate or something like that. You know, I don't know about it. Boy, I'm not sure. I mean, I imagine the first challenge would be from women who would file they would say it's an equal protection violation, that women essentially have this burden placed on them that men don't. And, it would be interesting. It's hard for me to predict. This is sort of outside my area of expertise. I'd say it's hard for me to predict how a court would view all of that. I would say this too. I mean, just to go a little bit beyond the question is, it seems to me that even if you aren't injured in some way by pregnancy, a pregnancy is a life altering choice by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman making a decision having the decision forced on her to bear a child means that she's changing her body forever, even if the baby's healthy and she hasn't had any complications, the fact of the matter is it's an extraordinary stress to put on someone, and it has consequences on them for the rest of their lives.
You know, one of the goals, of course, of during the campaign, President Trump kept saying that he would, when he was screening for Supreme Court justice nominations, he would strive to find those that would overturn Roe v. Wade. During the last year of President Obama's administration, he had the opportunity to replace the Supreme Court when Antonin Scalia passed away, but led by Mitch McConnell, they refused to allow the nomination process to go forward, saying that it was the last year, we're in an election year, we need to let the voters decide. Now, today he has said that if there is a vacancy during the last year leading into the election, he would nominate somebody. So, you know, I'm trying to understand, is this something where, well, that's what I said then, now I changed my mind and I feel differently about it, or, you know, this seems like a path of retribution for everybody going, as it already is. I know it's politics.
Well, I don't take Mitch McConnell seriously as someone who has views that go beyond whatever political expediency is. I mean, he appears to me to be someone who's willing to say anything to carry forward a political agenda. And his reelection campaign appears to be, the message appears to be, I've watched his opening ad, is I am going to do whatever it takes to push forward Trump's policies, and I am what's standing between, you know, the Democrats, and so you have to, you know, make sure that I'm reelected to defend us all from the Democrats. So the reporting on that statement is he essentially said that and sipped his tea,
right? And people in the room laughed.
Right. Well, he's basically willing to say anything.
Well, and to take in the success of having blocked Merrick Garland's appointment.
Right. What I would say is, you know, I think he said publicly, right, I watched the statement where McConnell said, the proudest moment of his career was when he went into the Oval Office and said, President Obama, you will not fill this Supreme Court vacancy. And, you know, there was cheering at that point. I will just say, you know, he is someone who appears to have no shame. And for him, it's all about an exercise of power. And, you know, there is certainly the case that if you believe in your ends, a lot of times people forgive the means of how you exercise power. But I would like to think that having some amount of principle is something that people history will take into account when they judge someone.
Oh, look at with your lofty ideals. It's Renato Mariotti, the host of On Topic. You can find the podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts. Again, that's On Topic with Renato Mariotti, and I get to hang out and ask questions because I'm a legal geek. And you can also catch him regularly on CNN. Follow him on Twitter at Renato Mariotti. Have a great night, sir.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. More after this on 720 WGN. I almost feel like there were a lot of things we didn't get to today, Ro. I feel like maybe we should do Tell Me Something Good, but maybe we should also, let's see, we didn't have time for it. You've heard the song, right?
We didn't have time for it.
Oh, no, I remember this one.
Time to talk about it. It did not make the show. It had to go. Maybe next time. I don't know. This is the end of the show.
Everyone dance. It's like all skates.
The end of the show. Go slow.
The top of my list for things that we didn't get to is, did you hear the press conference that Lori Lightfoot had after she met with city council today when they had their meetings today? Did you hear what she said? She said that Alderman Burke is basically trying to play games, and she said, and I quote, "I'm not having any of it."
Spoken in the true black girl magic.
I'm not having it. Well, he wanted to pull some. What are you doing? Is it me or you? What do you think?
I think it may be music playing too.
Oh, let me roll it down. There we go. Is that better?
Yep.
That might be. We don't know where the screeching was coming from. We apologize to everyone involved.
There it is.
Alderman Burke tried to call her on using the wrong pronouns on something, which I get, right? There are people who want to be sticklers for pronouns. There are people, hey, Alderman Burke, you want to go ahead and make sure that we are adhering to all the expectations of gender roles and titles and things like that, but basically not the time. She said, I loved it. Are you trying to say that your concern is this one thing? Okay, then we're moving on. It was great. I highly recommend.
Handled.
Yeah, handled. I like that. Also, did you see this pitch that was, are both of your mics on maybe? Because now, let me see.
Both of my mics, only have one.
I thought you had like two mics, like a little mic to talk to me in my ear and one mic for the air. No?
Oh, but you would be hearing me in your ear on the other end.
That's true. I don't know. There's a button over here that says breathy reverb. I wonder what that does. Can I push that button? No, I probably shouldn't.
I was like, please don't.
Breathy reverb? Ooh. We don't know where that's coming from. Hold on. Is it me? No. Hold on. I'm just going to wander around the studio. Nothing better than trying to find a squelching noise. So, did you... Oh, it sounds like it's coming from you. What did you just do?
I just cut some stuff off.
All right.
Uh-huh. All right. Okay.
All right. Let's keep going. Did you see the cameraman who was hit by the... This woman was throwing out the first pitch at the White Sox game yesterday. And she tagged him. He was off to the left. She was trying to throw it over the plate, obviously. Just nails this cameraman, hits him hard. I mean, he went down.
I've heard.
Yes.
I got a video because I got to see. Like, I've heard plenty of things about this, but.
Yeah. Well, it looks like, but and you know, obviously people are making jokes about how she throws. Did you see it?
It almost looks like she intentionally held on to the ball long enough to throw it directly at the camera.
Well, and it's across, it's to the, she's, you know, she's right-handed, but she throws it across her body to the left, because he's to the left of her, and she just hits him hard. Are you watching it on replay over and over again?
That's a very sharp cross.
Yeah. But the other thing is the way she throws it bugs me. I wish I could have gone out and thrown a few balls with her, maybe when she was younger. Because this seems like a bad. Think of throwing a ball like we have your back of your hand on your shoulder, and you're more like pushing it into the air rather than taking it and throw. I'm left handed, so I have to do it the other way.
Don't they practice this a couple times? I know Kendra G from WGCI. Mm-hmm. She did the ball throw. I want to say the game before last. When it was nice and hot outside.
Okay.
And they practiced. Like, she was showing behind the scenes footage and whatnot.
Yeah.
And usually they practice. So, well, happened.
It had some airtime. She was able to you know, get it airborne. And it seems like she threw it hard enough to knock him down.
I feel bad for his poor camera. Those things are expensive.
No kidding. Yeah, he said he's fine and that the camera is fine. A lot of people were wondering, because she stood there and started laughing. They were like, you didn't even go over and ask him if he's okay. I get in the moment of being in front of tens of thousands of people, I think my go-to, I'm not sure. Now that I've seen someone else mess it up horribly, I will definitely go find out if they're okay. It reminded me of Bull Durham when Kevin Costner tells him to hit the bull. You've never seen Bull Durham,
no,
have you? Okay, then.
That's over my head. I'm sorry.
I love Bull Durham. Hit the bull. What? Hit the bull. Anyway. Sorry, you have to see the movie. A lot going on in Springfield. I will be in Springfield covering any of the stories that happen over the next couple of days, but already they've done a lot of work. The Senate has passed legal recreational marijuana, and now it goes to the House. So they'll be debating that tomorrow. And it was a bipartisan vote, which is interesting, too. It was a 38-17 vote. The senators have sent the House a measure that, as Vic Vaughn has also been reporting, that residents over the age of 21 can legally possess 30 grams of cannabis. I don't know, how much is 30 grams? I mean, I'm talking like a bag, like a Ziploc bag, or is it? I'm not sure what the measurements of this is are like. I have no idea. 5 grams of cannabis concentrate, or 500 milligrams of THC contained in a cannabis infused product. Now, do police officers have to come around with like a scale? Do they, when they are suspect that you have something, and they measure how many grams you have? I don't know.
I think they eyeball it. The likelihood of the police officer sitting there with a mini scale
exactly,
for
right?
Like a gram.
Mm-hmm. When I worked at a hot dog joint on the far northwest side, Hollywood Hot Dog at the time, it's now Brandy's. We had to weigh the ice cream, the fountain machine, we had to weigh the ice cream before we, yeah. wonder if they use one of those scales.
That's
ounces.
Interesting. Well, yeah. There are little scale. I shouldn't know this, but I do. there are little scales, like miniature scales that your typical dealer would carry with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's to make sure that you got what you need.
Oh, yeah. I guess that makes sense. You want to have
money.
Yeah, honesty in the business, I guess. One of the Republican legislators who voted in favor of the legalizing recreational marijuana says that cannabis use is largely a personal choice. That, by the way, that's Senator Jason Berkman, who we've had on the show before. Excellent conversation, and he's a great legislator, serves the people of his district. He says the primary role of government to adopt safeguards to protect minors and safeguards to protect the public when an individual's use puts others in harm's way. And he was satisfied that the legislation has met the primary role of the government. So we'll see what happens next. And then they're going to talk about expanding legal gambling in the city. I'm not sure how I feel about expanding gambling. And that's...
my thing is, if you want to be that dumb and, like, throw your money away, do what you want to do, you know? It's the same way I feel about legalizing marijuana. Mm-hmm. To me, it's all prohibition, right?
Right.
So there was a time where alcohol was illegal,
right,
until the prohibition came along, and now you have more issues than before. And so I think that the same thing kind of lies, the same logic rather should lie when it comes to marijuana and when it comes to gambling. That's a personal decision. You only are affecting yourself. You gamble and you piss away $12,000.
Wow. Yeah, that's on you.
That's on you. And it's the same thing with marijuana. If you, you know, don't do anything all day, or you decide to overindulge and become unproductive, ultimately that's on you.
There you go. So saith Roe. Roe says.
Stamped. It is official.
It is stamped. And then they're going to be working on the budget, and we're also going to be working, they're going to be working on the spending bills. By the way, the roads need some work. Let's all be honest. Our roads need, so there was one street, I could not find a piece of pavement to put all four of my wheels through. Like, it was all pothole. It was the lesser of pothole hell evils. I had to choose which potholes to drive into.
Do we know if the CPSs are going to be open in August?
Why do you ask?
Because every year they go through this whole...
The strike thing?
Yeah.
I don't... It's only been... There was a time when we went without strikes going... We had gone, I think, 25, 26 years until Mayor Emanuel came into office, where we went without strikes. Daley had been able to work through it. Harold Washington had come to an agreement with the teachers unions. And so for a long period of time, there weren't these long teacher strikes until I want to say it was 4 or 5 years ago. I don't think we're in danger. I haven't heard
it's
any
every year. And the only reason I brought it up is to say, like, of all the things that we're concerned about where money should go, can we get our kids some new books, some good books? It's weird, you know. I was having a conversation with I'm not even gonna lie and say I remember her position, but I know she works for Chicago Public School District. And it's interesting how they do the funding. So funding is based off of tuition and the tax bracket of the neighborhood around it. So you have students in these lower income neighborhoods who are not only not getting a lot of money off of the housing income, but then turn around and because they don't have the books and the necessities, then they're getting hit with a double whammy and not getting funded because they're not testing well. And it's just this weird spiral.
Yes.
I always thought it was like all these other arguments and fights about things that ultimately to me become a personal decision. Can we get back to the things that we need? Like, can people eat? Can we make a bill that requires each student to have, you know what I mean, X amount of money throughout college or going into high school? I know that they said they're supposedly trying to put a bill together that starts every child off that's born after December 31st, 2019, this year, 2020, with $50. Like, really?
Oh, $50
to the college fund. That's what they were talking about on the news.
Oh, I was not aware. Oh, there you go. Well, you're right. I mean, there are things that we wish could be focused on. And there's a long history of the inequalities of the Chicago public school system. And they keep trying to figure out ways to catch up. And a lot of people are resistant. A lot of people are like, well, you know, my taxes should stay in my community, in my neighborhood. And that's why we have the better schools. And then people are like, well, but what are we going to do about the violence in parts of our city where we have basically shut down a lot of the schools and opportunities for progress? Also, before we go, there was one more story. I just wanted, since we're talking about CPS, there's a Chicago high school that has to reprint their yearbook because of the OK game. The OK circle game? What's it called? The Peyton High School, the number one high school in the state of Illinois, number 9 nationally, will be reprinting their books because there are about 6 photos in which students were posing with the circle game. And
what's the circle? Are you talking about? Is it the white power thing all over again?
Well, and that's what
upside down or something.
And they're all saying. And here's the point of the circle game is that somebody holds their hand. You know, you put your pointer finger and your thumb in a circle, like the OK symbol, and then you hold it below your waist, I guess. And then if someone looks, you punch them. And I don't know why people have to have an excuse to punch your friends. If you want to punch your friends, just punch your friends. But whatever, cause kids. But the other thing is that if the person, if they're able to, the other part of that, my husband was explaining, you're supposed to put your finger through the circle to avoid being punched before they punch you. Like, so without looking, you're supposed to like peripherally, I don't know, it's a whole thing.